Welcome to Voices of the Valley, a series interviewing growers, entrepreneurs, educators, and technologists who are inventing new solutions for today's and tomorrow's challenges on the farm. Brought to you today by the Western Growers Association, supporting growers that grow the best medicine in the world. Find out more at WGA.com. Now here's your Voices of the Valley host, Director of Western Growers Center for Innovation and Technology, Dennis Donahue.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Voices of the Valley. This is Dennis Donahue. I head up Western Growers Center for Innovation and Technology, and I'm joined with my good friend and partner, Candace Wilson from Green Venus. Candace, hello.
Good morning, and good morning to all of our listeners today.
And we're going to do something kind of fun today. You know, when you and I envisioned this series and we wanted to talk to some interesting people, and we were talking about it's a global game. I don't think there's a better ag tech ambassador for the planet than Peter Wren Hilton, who is the founder of Wharf 42. So we got him on the line. Now, as far as I know, today's the 23rd here. I'm going to take his word for it. It's the 24th where he is. So, Peter, welcome. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Wharf 42 and pick up on that comment a little bit that, you know, ag tech has always been a global game. And, you know, you certainly are a practitioner of dual hemisphere and traveling all over the planet. And you haven't been able to do that for a while. So talk a little bit about the ag tech game, how global it is and your experiences pre-pandemic and since it's got started, because, you know, from what Ferrari said, you're still moving around the planet.
Well, first of all, Dennis, great to speak to you this morning, and lovely to catch up with you, Candace, and good to speak within this kind of Western Grower call. So interesting set of intros there, Dennis. First of all, Wharf 42. Wharf 42 was actually established back in 2012 when I was living just up the road from you. I was based in Sunnyvale in Silicon Valley. And about 3 years after that, in 2015, I became very aware of the fact that there was a lot of investment taking place in this new asset class called agritech, but realized that very little of that investment was being made in New Zealand, which is where I'm from, and obviously where I'm talking from now. And I wasn't really too sure why, because agriculture in New Zealand is kind of a fundamental part of our economy. And so I came back home, and home to me is a place called Tauranga in North Island in New Zealand, and realized very quickly some of the challenges that the agritech sector in New Zealand faced. And so began to address those so that by the time we got to May 2018, I was able to establish Agritech New Zealand. And at that stage was able to bring together a number of major agribusinesses, government agencies, research organizations. And so today, Agritech New Zealand is a well-established industry group working very closely with both growers, agritech companies, and government. And it's a relationship that's worked really well. Now, obviously, the last 12 to 15 months have been quite challenging. We haven't been able to travel anywhere. And so my passport, sadly, has been very unused, which is fairly unusual because up till that point, I guess I was traveling offshore every 4 to 6 weeks. But the good news from a New Zealand perspective is that one of the benefits of a closed border is it means we've actually had no real COVID outbreaks here now for, well, almost 12 months. There've been one or two minor incursions at the border, but essentially life here is pretty normal and has been for months now. So to that end, living in New Zealand, although we're a small island or two islands in the middle of the South Pacific, it's been a pretty good time to be here. And work probably more domestically with our local agritech community.
Well, and speaking of working domestically, it sounds like the island or islands got back to work last week with your field days. Talk a little bit about that. You know, in California, we're familiar with the, you know, the World Ag Expo out of Tulare, but it sounds like we've got nothing on field days when you folks get together.
Well, yeah, absolutely. So look, field days last year, because of COVID, didn't take place, but it's actually the largest agricultural show in the Southern Hemisphere. And last week, over 135,000 of us gathered at a place called Mystery Creek, just outside Hamilton in North Island. And it was basically 4 days of an experience where farmers and growers were able to get together, There were over 1,000 exhibitors there. So you can imagine every type of appliance and application that might be used on the farm was present. There were a large number of presentations. It's a time of the year when farmers and growers can get together. And that was really evident last week, that people had kind of missed National Field Days the previous year. And it was just a great opportunity to get together. It's also a time, of course, when you might imagine that all the politicians turn up. So we had our Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister, ministers, opposition leaders, all trying to ply, I guess, the rural vote and show how committed they were to it. Although it's fair to say that, you know, because of the pandemic and those closed borders, our international tourist sector in the last 12 months has been nothing. And that was a very significant part of our economy. And so once again, agriculture has proven to be the backbone of New Zealand's economy. Interestingly enough, despite closed borders, agricultural production has gone up in terms of both volume and value. And so our dairy and meat exports in particular, but increasingly horticultural exports like kiwi fruit, avocado and apples, those all kind of kept the economy going over the last 12 to 15 months. And so last week was not just a case of an opportunity to get together. It was an opportunity really to celebrate what the primary sector, what the agricultural sector has achieved, at what we all regard as being very challenging times.
As you have traveled around the world, and then when you see these large events coming together, can you talk a little bit about some of the major trends and the common themes of ag technology and kind of, I'm curious, it's such a broad term and we've been so much money and energy and effort has been pumped into it. What are some of the victories that seem to be rising to the top as well?
So that's a great question. And, you know, I've known Dennis for a number of years now, and, you know, we've talked in the past about some of the challenges facing Western grower members. To be honest, those challenges are not restricted to Western growers. They're fairly global. So if I just pick on a couple of those, the first thing we'll look on in terms of trends and challenges is labour. The lack of labour worldwide is producing huge challenges for agriculture sector, both farmers and growers, particularly in developing countries. So I know in California, Arizona, Nevada, the lack of labour is causing a challenge, both in terms of lack of numbers, but also cost. And that's impacting on growers' ability to actually, you know, harvest fruit and harvest vegetables. The same applies to New Zealand. Again, with our closed borders, we weren't able to bring in our normal seasonal workers this year. And so the horticultural sector in particular was challenged. Kiwi fruit, where I live in the Bay of Plenty, is our major local industry. Although we're a relatively small region, we generate about $2.5 billion worth of exports in kiwi fruit. The same challenge facing apple growers in Hawke's Bay, wine growers in Marlborough. You know, the ability to actually harvest and pick fruit has been a real challenge this year. And I think what that's meant is that there's a much greater focus now on automation. And so one of the big trends here, certainly in New Zealand, and I see this not just here, I see this across the Tasman in Australia, and certainly in North America, this trend towards robotics and automation. How can we begin to automate more of the farming process? Now, that's never going to simply replace labour, but it will very much complement labour. And so one of the big challenges we face going forward is how do people and machines work together? And I think that's going to be one of the big trends over the coming years. The other big trend, I think, also, which again has been partly driven by COVID, is the whole issue of food security. I do quite a bit of work with Singapore. So one of the hats I wear is I'm a senior advisor to the nascent Agri-Food Tech Association in Singapore. And Singapore realized last year that it actually imports 90% of its food. So it only produces 10% of its food domestically, which clearly means it's potentially quite vulnerable in the case of a pandemic. And so last year, it decided it would introduce a policy called 30-30. That is, increase domestic food production to 30% by 2030. Now, the challenge, obviously, that Singapore has got is it's got very little land. And so the only way it's going to be able to produce that food is through looking at new ventures such as vertical farming, cellular meat, cellular dairy, intensive aquaculture. So these are other trends which I see emerging. And you know, as we face that other big long-term trend or impact, which is our changing climate, and we can talk about climate change in many different ways, but what we can accept is the climate is changing, is we will be looking potentially at alternative food methods of protein production. So I think things like vertical farming in controlled environments, things like cellular meat and alternative proteins are going to, again, become big trends going forward.
So well, I think it sounds like Singapore with, you know, with all of its financial resources and that goal, I mean, that could really be the world's proving ground for, you know, vertical farming and, you know, some of the alternative proteins you're talking about, because they figured out they can scale there, it would seem.
Yeah, and I think, Dennis, that's very much one of their hopes. They're certainly positioning themselves right now as being a major agri-food hub, certainly a major agri-food hub in Southeast Asia. But my view is that a lot of the technology that will emerge from Singapore will have a global application. And as you said, there's no lack of funding there. The major Singapore sovereign fund, Temasek, has already announced it's setting up a separate multi-billion dollar, that's multi-billion US dollar fund to look at food. And so I expect a lot of innovation to take place there over the coming months and years.
And did you see these similar trends, you know, when the 135,000 people gathered, was there any fantastic or kind of, groundbreaking technology that you saw or was stirring up some sort of noise at the show?
Yes and no. I mean, I think we saw a lot of what I call incremental improvements on existing technology. Mm-hmm. Some of the most exciting areas of new technology I look at, though, aren't actually in the form of machinery or software. It's really in the form of genetics. And there's some really interesting developments taking place both in animal genetics and plant genetics. So going back to what I was saying before about the increase of focus on automation and robotics, really interesting, and I know this is beginning to be seen now in Washington State, in Northwest America, is the development of two-dimensional apple trees. And so rather than having apple trees with lots of branches, which are very difficult for robots to actually pick apples, particularly if there's any wind, you're now getting two-dimensional apple trees that look more like vines. And so you get avenues of these vines. And I see a lot of genetics now taking place are really targeting other types of pip fruit. Because it's one thing to develop machines and develop robots, but you need to have growing systems that can work within those automation and the robotic kind of environments. And so I see a lot of work taking place currently in plant genetics. I mentioned the fact that I come from Tauranga, which is, I say, is the home of kiwi fruits, big industry here. And really interesting to see the work that Plant and Food Research and Zespri are carrying out in terms of new cultivars, new types of kiwi fruit. And so we're very familiar with green kiwi fruit. 4 or 5 years ago, we introduced gold kiwi fruit. Well, we now have red kiwi fruit. And these are targeting very specific markets, particularly in Southeast Asia, where people like the color, they like their kiwi fruit to be a bit sweeter. And so this genetic work is really beginning to not simply grow the range of a particular product, in this case, kiwi fruit, but also tailor it for individual global customer taste. And I think that's another very interesting trend where you're seeing crops and vegetables being developed for specific markets as opposed to just a single product targeting the whole market. That also, incidentally, is the way to increase value. If you're purely in the volume game, price is only going to go one way, and that's going to be down. If you want price to go up, you have to identify niche markets. And I think that's something that New Zealand growers are very good at.
Well, you know, Peter, we're very familiar with the phrase price takers in our neck of the woods. We're often envious when New Zealand talks about premiums. So we'll pay close attention to your efforts and results in that regard. Plant genetics, Candace, that's a fastball down the middle for you. You must have some questions or thoughts about that.
You know, Peter, I just kind of wanted to hug you when you said that. So I have spent most of my entire career working for genetics companies. So starting with the Seminis and the specialty crops. And rarely when we talk about ag tech, like almost never when I ask that sort of question, people don't talk about genetics. I have to like pull everybody into a genetics conversation and try to remind them of the significance of genetics. But I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's something that I always remind people is going to be critical to us succeeding as we go forward. And it's not as sexy as a cool new robot, but it's so important. And it's important that we get ahead of these sorts of conversations and try to marry the two conversations or the two discussions and strategies that are taking place, because one can't succeed without the other. And the genetics really is, it's something that you have got to get a head start on. So I'm happy to hear you bring up genetics.
Well, and Peter, you know, in your neck of the woods in New Zealand, I mean, I think everyone would give New Zealand for high marks, being concerned about the environment, the future of the planet. So when genetics comes up and new technologies and that type of deal, is that a well-received conversation down there, or is it controversial? I mean, are people, it sounds like people are open to, you know, the very positive results that genetics can deliver.
I think there are two aspects, Dennis, there to genetics. I think you might be referring to GE, genetic engineering, which certainly is a robust discussion that we need to have in New Zealand. So right now, GE is not something that New Zealand really works with. So in terms of the use of CRISPR technology, there are certain research organizations here that have what I call legal compounds where they can use CRISPR as an example to work on certain options, but it's not something that's widely spread. That said, the New Zealand government invests very significant amounts of taxpayer dollars into research. And so we have some very, very well-funded Crown Research Institutes like AgriResearch, Landcare, Plant and Food Research, who invest literally hundreds of millions of dollars a year into researching primarily around genetics. It's a very significant consumer of that public investment. And I think it's therefore not just for creating new kind of varietals of apples and kiwi fruit. It's also, I guess, looking further ahead. One of the areas that WAR 42 is particularly involved with at the moment is climate and looking at the long-term implications of the climate. So I'll use this as a kind of little bit of a promo opportunity.
Well, I was hoping you would. You've got a big event coming up in the fall.
We've got a couple of reasonably large events. We've basically at COP26 in November this year, which is the big United Nations conference looking at climate change. It's the follow-up to the Paris Climate Accord. And great to see from my perspective now that the US is once again very much on board the whole climate change issue. But we're co-hosting the Agri-Food Tech Climate Summit at COP26 in Glasgow in November. Now, I had hoped to be there. I think the reality is that it's going to be a virtual event, but we will have a live panel in Glasgow. So there will be people, real people, sitting on chairs in Glasgow, but I unfortunately will be almost certainly...
Well, the New World Order, hybrid.
Absolutely. I'll almost certainly still be in New Zealand. But we did announce during National Field Days last week that we're also going to be hosting the 2035 Oceania Summit in Auckland in April next year. And that will be the first kind of post COP26 regional climate event. And that's going to bring together Australia, New Zealand, and the Pacific Islands to talk about the very specific challenges that we face with climate. And where this is relevant for genetics is that as farmers and growers around the world face, you know, a long-term changing climate, we need to think of ways in which we can develop more resilient, you know, crop platforms, crop species, because, you know, the fires that you've experienced on the West Coast, and certainly Australia had bushfires last year, and the terrible floods that are occurring around the world, these are just going to become, you know, more frequent. And so we need to have crops that can basically survive in this changing world, particularly at a time when the world's population is increasing. So, you know, we've always talked about 2050 as being a definitive date. That's when we need to produce or increase food production from today by about 40% to feed that population. But if we're having to produce or increase that production at a time when, you know, soil is being degraded through climate and we're getting these, extreme weather events, then I think genetics has got a huge role to play to really work through what crop systems and plant systems might look like in the future.
No, that's a great comment. In fact, you know, it's interesting. I know we're, if you've been on the ag tech circuit, we're all kind of used to that 2050 date in terms of, you know, quadrupling of the world's middle class or whatever the working number is. And it seems like there's kind of been a break in the action in terms of that's kind of described as the goal. But, you know, we've been working on our automation initiative and our good friends in Washington State, where we're talking about that, you know, a couple of years from now, that conversation is really going to pick up again in earnest. And you know, it's, the wonderful world of ag tech, the labor can be the fire drill, the water can be but the reality is, you know, there are going to be some key drivers. And obviously climate change is, and the impact of that is right in the middle of it. And certainly in California now with, you know, back in the middle of the drought, you know, you can pick apart certain parts of the state, like, well, there's going to be some challenges with water there. And, you know, ground's going to go fallow and that type of thing. So, that whole issue of resiliency that you alluded to earlier is important. I do want to pick up on, you know, one of the things, and you do move around the planet, whether it's virtually or your passport was in use. You know, New Zealand, it seems to me, does an awfully good job of integrating government, education, and industry, more so really than most countries. Obviously we have all of those elements in the United States, but, talk about the value of that integration from your perspective. And because the one thing all of us are interested in is, you know, how do we accelerate results these days? So is New Zealand a particularly adept practitioner at that? And two, does it benefit the industry down there in terms of results maybe coming online a little quicker?
Yeah, so I would say, Dennis, in one simple word is yes. I mean, we've been actively involved, as I said, coming back from Silicon Valley back in 2015, I've been actively engaged with government, industry, research ever since. And I think one of the great values of having that kind of collaborative partnership running between government, research and industry is that we are able to focus on, you know, certain key drivers, certain key strategies. And I think that's probably best exemplified by a strategy that was developed and launched by the government in July last year. It was called the Agritech Industry Transformation Plan, ITP for short. And what the Agritech ITP did is it identified 6 or 7 work streams that would accelerate activity within Agritech in New Zealand. And that brought together all the types of stakeholders that you've referred to. So government agencies, rather than having 5 or 6 government agencies working separately, they came together to create a single task force. And my experience, not just in New Zealand, but, you know, globally, is that very often you find that government agencies work as silos. They don't share a lot of information with other government agencies. That's just the way that government tends to work. Well, certainly in New Zealand, we overcame that with the creation of the ITP. So you have this single government task force working with Agritech New Zealand, which is the key industry body, which is acting as kind of a delivery partner. But that includes, through its membership, research organizations, major agribusinesses, startups, investors. And so you have this whole group of stakeholders coalescing into a single collaborative network, really targeting the same key themes and work streams. So I think it's a very, very positive move. I think the other reason why New Zealand is a good example for this is that we're a pretty small country. Our population is only 5 million. And because we are detached physically, geographically from the rest of the world, it makes a lot of sense for the country to work as one. And so I think that is also one of the reasons why government, industry and research do work so closely together. But I don't want us to sound as though we're kind of, isolated from the rest of the world. Being small actually has certain advantages. It means that for many of our particularly emerging agri-tech businesses, they're thinking global from day one. And so I'm not the only person that has air miles and a well and truly stamped passport. Many of our early stage companies know that they need to get out of New Zealand as quickly as possible in order to go to larger markets. And I know the Western Growers Innovation Centre in Salinas has seen two or three of those companies. So companies like TrackMap, who I'm sure you're aware of.
Right. So what advice do you give them before you send them off from New Zealand and say, okay, now you're off to America? What do you tell them?
So again, it comes back to this level of support that they get before they leave. And so, we've got government agencies such as New Zealand Trade and Enterprise that actually have an office in San Francisco. And so any New Zealand tech company or agri-tech company heading to California will have the support of people on the ground. But they don't just go there kind of as what I might call Californian virgins. We provide as much support and advice as we can before they leave. And so when they leave, they're pretty well teamed up. And as you know, we've brought over agri-tech delegations to Silicon Valley for the last 5 years. And so there's quite a strong understanding, not only as to what the valley looks like, but particularly in the case of Western Growers, the challenges that Western Growers members face. So whether that's Taylor Farms, whether that's Driscoll's in the California in the Salinas area, they do have some understanding of the challenges that you folk are facing. I want to pick up though, if I may, on that international flavor on a comment you made at the very beginning, when you mentioned dual hemisphere. And I think this goes to the heart of the points, again, that Candace made around genetics. I think one of the problems sometimes is if you base yourself totally in your local environment, you only get one season a year to trial and test technology. We're very, very keen in New Zealand to see how we can set up dual hemisphere partnerships with countries in the Northern Hemisphere, because that then enables our researchers and our startups to actually test and trial their technologies in two growing seasons. And so when I look at New Zealand, at our pastoral growing systems, particularly around dairy and livestock, I then look at Ireland, which is a very similar kind of growing system of pastoral farming. It makes a lot of sense, therefore, for New Zealand and Ireland to have a close working relationship. So Kiwi companies can go up to Ireland during our off season. Irish companies can come down to New Zealand. And that's exactly what happens. And one of the things that happened last week during National Field Days, going back to the big show, was that Agritech New Zealand and a brand new organization called Agritech Ireland signed a memorandum of understanding, basically to identify ways in which we could increase that level of collaboration. And I think one of the best benefits of that collaboration will be that dual hemisphere cooperation to enable us to really accelerate research and not rely on just research in our own backyard. And again, I think that's one of that reasons why personally I'm so engaged, I guess, in global outreach. Looking at what we're doing here is fantastic, but actually seeing how we can connect that to the rest of the world is really important going forward.
When you think about, and I'm kind of coming back to the genetics conversation, the significance of genetics, and you spoke specifically about CRISPR. New Zealand has been one of the countries that has basically followed Europe. I don't know which one declared their position first, but those are hard no countries in terms of their openness to gene editing. You see the tone, and I'm bringing this up because when we look at the tools available to bring new varieties and solve problems with genetics, the power and speed of gene editing really is, editing is the power horse to make changes in a quick way. I see that Europe is starting to kind of review some of their positioning. How do you see that conversation evolving at all in New Zealand? And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, I'm very, very pleased to. So I need to make it, first of all, very clear. I do not speak on behalf of the New Zealand government. So that's my big disclaimer.
Sure.
this is purely a personal view. But
Darn it, I knew we should have booked the Prime Minister. I hear she's accessible down there.
Well, no. Our Prime Minister is. I am actually going to quote from one of our government ministers. I will keep that minister's name nameless for obvious reasons. But I think it's a conversation that I had in Wellington probably 2 to 3 years ago when I was speaking to a couple of New Zealand government ministers. And then the attitude towards GM and CRISPR was a very strong no. So you're absolutely right. Traditionally speaking, and I think for the last kind of 10, 15 years, New Zealand's official position on GE has been, it's not something that we believe would necessarily enhance the New Zealand brand, particularly in terms of global perception, potentially of our food. There is a view amongst a number of New Zealand producers that the fact that our food, particularly our meat and our dairy, is purely pasture-based, it's grass-fed, that tends to resonate with global consumers and tends to attract premium prices. If they felt that there was any interference through CRISPR or GE technology, then that might devalue that premium view. There is, however, I think, a changing view. And I spoke to the same minister within the last 12 months. And rather than the strong no, the term was that was used was time for a robust discussion. And so I think there is a view that CRISPR in particular does offer opportunities, even within New Zealand, to develop some of the new genetic technologies that we're talking about. There's one great example, I think, of one of our big Crown Research Institutes here is called Ag Research. They've recently done quite a bit of work offshore, developing with partners a new type of ryegrass, which when put into pasture, reduces the amount of methane emissions from cattle. Now, methane emissions, as we know, is a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. New Zealand is very committed towards addressing climate change. And I think it's that type of use of genetics and that type of use of CRISPR, which is making a bit of a rethink now in government, because if it can be proven that CRISPR technology can help reduce greenhouse gases in that one instance, then it actually is seen to have a benefit. Perhaps we're still slightly constrained by the traditional old-fashioned view of GE going back 20 to 30 years ago. I think I can mention the word Monsanto because it's now disappeared. It's now part of Bayer. But I think there's still that kind of thing that GE might produce kind of two-headed cows or three-headed sheep. Well, we know that's not the case with CRISPR. And I think that understanding is beginning to kind of seep in, particularly to government and policymakers, that maybe it's something that needs to be reviewed. So my personal view is that within the next 12 months, 2 years, there will be a more stringent, robust debate taking place within New Zealand about the value of CRISPR. And at some point in the future, I would not be that surprised to see regulation around it being loosened.
Thank you for your comments. I want to just for maybe for the well-being of our listeners too, who may not be as familiar with a gene-edited product versus a GMO product, the very simple, straightforward difference is that there are no outside sources of DNA. There is not an outside source of DNA being inserted into the new crop that you're working on. So you are simply editing an organism's DNA. You're not bringing in new sources of DNA. So an apple is an apple, and apple does not have orange DNA, as an example. And what you say also that I think is just really, you made such a good point. The way I think about CRISPR and its power, we have deadlines. We've talked about the significance of food security in some countries. We've talked about what is the significance of 2050. And from my perspective, we need to be open to thinking through and understanding what is the power of all the tools that we have in our toolbox. And so that's the open mind sort of spirit that I think we need to, take that sort of approach when we're thinking about the new technologies.
Well, it sounds like the conversation is changing, and robust discussion is a good frame. And, if you think back to also, particularly on the plant side, with all the things fruits and vegetables are going to have to contend with, whether it's drought, lack of water, disease, et cetera. So it's, you know, I think that's encouraging to hear, because I think folks will certainly acknowledge New Zealand as a real leader in that global conversation. And speaking of, you know, that world beater attitude or those efforts from our good friends in New Zealand, I'm really intrigued by your GroundUp.Earth initiative, you know, that global collaborative problem solving platform. Talk a little bit about that. That's an awfully impressive effort. You know, what is it and how's it going?
Thank you for raising that, Dennis. So this is a collaborative arrangement between WAR42 and an organization up in the UK called foodforward.tech. And Rob Ward, who's my colleague in the UK who's looking after this, is actually also the agritech lead for the United Kingdom's Department of International Trade, their Global Entrepreneur Program. And so he's very well connected with government. And this is really a platform designed to address some of the world's big issues. And we've mentioned some of them through this podcast, you know, issues around how do we feed 10 billion people in 2050? How do we address some of the challenges faced by a changing climate? And what we have both kind of worked through is that no single entity or company or university can solve all these problems. The only way that these problems can be solved is by developing a collaborative framework to enable researchers from multiple universities, companies to work together. And so GroundUp.Earth is really a platform which is building up that collaborative framework. And so what we're looking to do is to attract the best minds from the best universities, research organizations, companies, government agencies to come together to see how we can get them to operate in that kind of collaborative framework. Because, you know, there is an element of urgency. Candace talked before about, you know, how, you know, CRISPR is addressing some of the urgent issues. Well, you know, the time clock is kind of already started. And when we're looking at 2050, when we're looking at, you know, a changing climate, these things are happening today. And despite closed borders and our inability potentially to travel for another 12 months, well, if we take the view we can't do anything for 12 months, then that's, in my view, 12 months lost. So to actually address some of these issues, we need to do that today. So right now, Rob and myself are just working through the logistics as to how the platform will work. And we expect to be able to make some more kind of official announcements literally within the next 2 to 3 months. My hope, though, is to have this platform up and running by the end of this year, calendar year. And if we can have it coinciding with COP26 in November, perfect opportunity to socialize the opportunity to that wider global research market.
Well, you've certainly been one of the busier Zoomer players on the planet this past year, haven't you? I want to go back to something we alluded to at the beginning. You know, Western Growers has just launched a strategic initiative utilizing our regional program brand, AgTech X, and we're going to stripe it with a education banner for a series of events that we're real fortunate that our California Department of Food and Ag Secretary Karen Ross is going to join us, and we're going to get started in at Reed Lee College at the end of August. And, you know, at the end of the day, for all the talk about ag tech and new technologies, you know, one of the things that's become real, real clear to me and a lot of my colleagues in Western Growers is, you know, the ability to implement an ag tech strategy script is going to depend also on a skilled workforce that is, you know, is familiar with the skills that are going to be needed for a world that's arguably going to be more STEM-based, more tech savviness required. What are you seeing down in your neck of the woods in terms of how that issue is getting addressed? We've certainly talked about labor shortages for the world as we understand it today in ag already. And rather than get even further behind the curve, you know, we're certainly trying to promote the conversation and getting with education to go, hey, we got to talk about this sooner rather than later. What do you see from a New Zealand perspective? And indeed, as you've kind of moved around the world, is that an issue that's being addressed?
Again, as before, the answer is yes. So first of all, Dennis, congratulations for the work that you and Karen Ross are doing. It's been really interesting to see how that conversation has developed, you know, as recently as the last 6 months. And you know, I know that you and Walt and others at Western Growers are very proactive in you know, looking at the future workforce and the skills that it will require. We had exactly the same conversation here 2 years ago when I was executive director of Agritech New Zealand. And I sat down with the Agritech ITP task force, that government task force I mentioned before. So the Agritech ITP program that was launched by government in July last year contains six work streams. On one of those work streams focused exclusively on skills and talent, because we also realized the need to educate and bring up a new type of workforce. Farming and growing, you know, horticulture, not whether it's livestock or horticulture, is changing. You know, the farm of the future is going to look very different from the farm of today. There's going to be far more digital activity taking place, whether that's looking at sensor technologies, the use of drones, the use of robots. And so the skills and talents that farm workers and growers are going to require will be quite different from those of today. And so we recognize that, and that's not therefore just from, you know, a New Zealand perspective. I see exactly the same challenges across the Tasman in Australia, where, again, one of my other hats is I'm senior advisor to the Australian Agritech Association. I sit on both the Evoke Ag and Grow Ag steering committees and spend quite a lot of time. In fact, I'm subject to borders remaining open. We do have at the moment a bubble with Australia. I'm actually flying over to Sydney for 3 weeks in 2 weeks' time. And I'll be traveling to New South Wales and to ACT and to South Australia, speaking to a number of Agritech players over there at both government and industry level. And my expectation is that this whole issue of the skilled workforce of the future will, again, just raise its head. I think it's something that we're all very, very familiar with. And as we move from this kind of very traditional type of farming, which I'm going to use the word analog, to a more digital farm of the future, that is going to require a different type of workforce. And so the skills and talent that you're trying to address, you know, with Karen Ross over in California, no real different to the challenge and that we're facing here in New Zealand. And I know, speaking to colleagues across the Tasman in Australia and also colleagues up in the UK and Ireland, very, very similar challenges. So I think it's a hot topic and one that will emerge as a more important topic going forward.
No, I agree. And you know, as we kind of close our conversation, you know, as you kind of look around the planet, as you do, we've talked about, you know, New Zealand, Australia, we've talked about Singapore, you know, with a last name like Donahue, I always like to hear, you know, the Irish are getting in the game, and the UK and Europe. What are some of the other centers of gravity that we haven't addressed in terms of, you know, who's really on this ag tech thing and will be part of the clusters that that really helps create the future? What other parts of the world should we be thinking about?
Well, I've actually got a telephone call with one of them in about 3 hours' time. I'm speaking to Effie Levy, who I think I've mentioned to you before, Dennis, in Israel.
Okay.
So I think Israel is a great example of an agritech hub. They've had a tremendous story over the past few years. They export, I think, just off the top of my head, about $13 to $14 billion worth of ag tech product. They're obviously in a very unique position, but when I think of water and irrigation, I immediately think of Israel as being kind of global leaders in that space. Another area, if I'm looking at, or another country, is Holland. I think the Dutch have done great work. Hard to believe that they're the second world's largest exporters of agricultural produce, given the size of their landmass. But of course, they've become global experts, particularly in a lot of greenhouse, glasshouse work, very, very strong in horticulture. So I look upon those two countries. There's some great work taking place in Denmark. You've mentioned the UK and Ireland. I'm not going to let you get away from Ireland with that name, Donahoe. They're doing some great work over there. But I know the UK. And I think the UK is a particularly interesting country at the moment, you know, having just gone through Brexit and disassociated it slightly or disestablished itself slightly away from the rest of Europe. food security for the UK is also very important. And I know that last year, the government there invested $800 million into agritech. So that, I'm not sure, I think about $1.4 billion into agritech came out of central government to support the agritech sector. So I think there are a number of countries around the world where agritech is seen as being increasingly important as this whole issue of food supply and food security grows. So just finishing from my point of view, in terms of that passport, I'm incredibly excited about going to Australia in 2 weeks, which is crazy because I used to go there a lot, but having not been out of New Zealand now for 18 months, I'm inexplicably happy. The only problem is when I get back, I'm going to be incredibly frustrated looking at the world map, saying, where can I go to next? And I'm really looking forward when I can to come over to Salinas and catch up with you and the team at Western Growers. And
well, we're anxious to have you back. And you know, Candace, you wanted kind of a tour of the world when we thought about this a few weeks ago. I think you'll agree Peter's done a pretty good job moving us around the planet on ag tech.
I don't think we could have asked for a better representative. Peter, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today. Like Dennis mentioned, taking us a tour on the world, around the world. And I hope we get to have a dinner date sometime soon.
Look, it's been a lot of fun. And I would love to go to one of those amazing restaurants that you have in the high street down in Salinas. Looking forward to it. And hoping that, and I think I might have mentioned this before, Dennis, but hoping that the Forbes conference takes place in June next year and we can come over and have a beer with you and, have some good times.
Well, you know, I happen to know the mayor of Salinas and the city manager, so I think they'd both say from your lips to God's ears, we get Forbes back in June. I know they're excited about that that possibility, and it'd be great to see you. You know, in the meantime, you know, second place would be we can all meet in Ireland on March 17th. So we'll take that.
Sounds good for me.
Yeah, no, always remember St. Patrick's Day is important, Peter. So.
How do you say one of those other great global dates?
There you go. Listen, we really appreciate your time and sharing what you're up to and your experience past and present. And we're going to knock on wood for you, and we hope those travel plans to Australia don't have to change, and hope everyone stays safe and healthy in New Zealand. So, and good to catch up, and I have a sneaky suspicion we'll be in touch soon.
I have a sneaky suspicion you might be right, Dennis. Lovely to speak to you, buddy.
Terrific to talk to you. Thanks, Peter.
All the best.
With that, there is another episode, and dare say it, I think a pretty interesting one, Candace, of Voices of the Valley, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to the Voices of the Valley podcast, brought to you today by Western Growers Association, supporting producers that grow the best medicine in the world. Find out more at WGA.com.